floor session scheduled on us this afternoon. So for those of you who've been waiting, we do apologize. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 487. I'm going to open that public hearing and ask Senator Metzger to come forward and bring with you Ms. Hoffman, if you would, please.
Thank you, Chairman Williams, members of the committee, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and I'll be brief and let Deputy Hoffman speak. Senate Bill 487 comes to you from Senator John Menas and myself, and it actually arose out of the discussion I had with Deputy Hoffman from Hood River. In your packets, members, you have previous testimony from Deputy Hoffman and also testimony from Jim Dorr of Albany Police Department, who testified on the Senate side. 487 corrects a negligent, piece in our law that allows the public, the animal control officer of the police departments to be also considered as, in fact, peace officers for the public safety officer category. And I think it's very surprising to individuals, certainly it was to me and Senator Menas, and I know with Deputy Hoffman, to find out in the most difficult situations that the officers were not considered in the protections that were afforded public safety officers. You may have noticed in today's Statesman Journal that two dogs were killed in a raid on a drug house in the Salem area, aggressive dogs. And as you see from the testimony from Mr. Dorr, what is very common is that the animal officer is often the first ones to have to go in some of the most dangerous situations because, as Deputy Dorr testified in the Senate, because the other officers don't want to get bit. And so they send them in first. And they actually confront these criminals often on the very first encounter. This would place this in the statute that the animal control officer is afforded the same protection as the other officers for an assault on a public safety officer. And I would like, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, to turn it over to Deputy Hoffman, who will tell you her story and why this bill has been brought to you today.
Welcome.
Thank you. I am really glad to be here. Really, truly. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Becky Hoffman, and I live at 4153 Chandler Drive, Mount Hood, Oregon, one of the most gorgeous parts of our state, I'm sure you all know. I've been a deputy with Hood River County for over 10 years. It'll be 11 years this summer, doing the animal control, the only animal control deputy for the entire county. That includes the town of Hood River and three smaller cities as well. I'm very happy to be here to talk about this bill and what it means to me. I go to work every day wearing a uniform and a badge. Long gone is that vision we all had of the dog catcher who was the little guy chasing the mongrel dog down the street with a net. Animal control officers today are educated professionals who serve your community by enforcing laws and regulations of the state and the county. They impound stray, sick, or injured animals and hold animals for rabies quarantine testing as well, which I know a lot of people are not aware that we have to deal with that portion of the law as well. Duties performed by animal control officers include investigating possible cruelty to animals, answering citizens' complaints, catching stray, dangerous, or destructive animals, investigating livestock damage and death claims, neighborhood civil disputes. We assist sheriff's deputies, city police officers, game units, and even fire and rescue. They'll actually, fire and rescue will send us into a real bad situation to look for the animals before they even go in. Contacts we make in a day often include drug dealers, animal abusers, hoarders, animal rights activists, who sometimes can be the worst, and citizens who value their pets' lives far above ours. Our daily challenge is to leave a positive impression and educate each and every person that we come in contact with. Last year in December, I attended a week-long session of classes for animal control officers that was put on by the Missouri Law Enforcement Institute. There were over 30 officers from all over the United States that were in attendance there. Well over a third of them had been assaulted at some point during their job, including myself. In November of 2000, I responded to a simple complaint of barking dogs, and it was out at a rural location. When I got to the residence, both the husband and wife were home. They both came to the door, and within 30 seconds, they were screaming and yelling not only at me, but at each other. They were complaining about problems they'd had with neighbors, people who didn't live there any longer, problems they had with the sheriff, problems they had with the Department of Agriculture. I can't begin to even tell you. It was so frantic and so disjointed. I decided that probably the best way to deal with it was to just try to leave. And tried to make an excuse to leave. And as I started walking towards my vehicle, she started screaming at me, "You're not going anywhere," and stayed right here with me. It was screaming and yelling in my face, around back behind me. And he was screaming at her to leave me alone, and then actually asked me to just stay. And I said, "I don't think so. It's time for me to go." And as I got closer to the vehicle, she actually ran on ahead, threw herself spread-eagled over the door of my vehicle, and said, "You are not going anywhere, and nobody's going to help you." So I'm thinking now they've got a hole dug out there somewhere just waiting to put an animal control officer in it. I could not understand in my head what in the world they could want with me. I asked them again. I asked her, "Please let me have my vehicle," and she just said, refused. I had a portable radio with me, and I contacted dispatch, and as I'm contacting dispatch asking for backup, which is probably at the best 20 minutes away, she just starts screaming and hollering more about how they're not going to be able to help you. The sheriff can't help you. There's not a deputy out there that can help you. You're not going anywhere. So I really began to get a little panicked, and I thought, if I can just reach my hand in behind her — she's sprawled like this over my rig — if I can reach my hand in behind her and just kind of boop her off the door, I'll have it made out and get in my truck and drive out of there. Well, that was the big mistake, because when I got in close enough to her, she cut loose and she hit me so hard that it knocked me backwards and spun me clear around. My face immediately burst into blood. I mean, just held it like this, and they never stopped screaming. They never stopped screaming at each other. They never stopped screaming at me. He started screaming at her, "Look what you've done." She started screaming, I mean, I don't even know what. And I asked again, "Can I have my vehicle?" And they refused. So I decided to leave on foot. And as I turned to walk away down the driveway to the county road and try to make my way to the nearest neighbor, I could hear her screaming at him, "Go get her, go get her." I thought, holy moly. So then I started running to the neighbor's. I got to the neighbor's house, pounded on the door, and of course, nobody was home. But I heard him start his vehicle, drive down his driveway, and start down the county road where I was to come to this residence. So I did the next best thing that I could do, tried the door, it was locked, and so ran for the bushes. I hid in the brush, and I watched him drive on down the county road, on down to a bus turnaround, turn around, and drive very slowly back up looking for me. And I just elected to stay hidden until the first deputy came. And upon his arrival, this woman was arrested and taken to jail for assault on a public safety officer, which is a Class C felony and holds a 14-day mandatory jail sentence. 5 minutes, literally 5 minutes before the trial was to begin, the judge made a determination that animal control officers are not public safety officers and threw the case out. She was tried on a much lesser charge of assault in the fourth degree, which is simply a Class A misdemeanor. This event sent a terrible message to all of the communities and all of the animal control officers in the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 487 simply adds animal control officers to the definition of public safety officer as it pertains to officers as assault victims. It's very important for us to have the added extra protection, and we deserve it as law enforcement officers. I'd like to thank Senator Metzger for knocking on my door and listening to what I had to say. I will be forever grateful, and I thank you all very much for giving me the opportunity to speak. And if anyone would have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for your story.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Next up, Lieutenant Covey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is Lieutenant Randy Covey with the Law Enforcement Division of the Oregon Humane Society, also Vice President of the Oregon Animal Control Council, and it's in that role that I appear before you today in support of Senate Bill 487. I'll keep my testimony brief. Deputy Hoffman has made a compelling case already. But I can tell you that over 15 years in animal control and with my current position, Oregon Humane Society, I've seen staff working under me slapped, threatened with firearms, and chased with baseball bats and axes. Lane County recently made bulletproof vests available to its officers, and I can tell you from experience that's for safety, not for comfort. On behalf of the OACC and the animal control officers we represent, I urge you to support Senate Bill 487 and move it to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Randy. Are there questions for Lieutenant Covey, Representative Prasanna?
Just a real quick question.
are the animal control officers sworn officers through DPSST?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Brzezanski, some officers are and some are not. It varies by city and county across the state.
And in my understanding, this bill is only going to modify the definition as it pertains to the crime of assault on a public safety officer.
That's my understanding, yes.
That's correct.
Anything else for Lieutenant Covey? Thank you very much, Randy. Susan Russell.
Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. OCDLA opposes Senate Bill 47. While we're sensitive to the concerns that have been addressed here, to the personal circumstances that Deputy Hoffman described, it's our organization's position that the statute is adequately drafted and expansive enough and should not be expanded to include further definitions.
Thanks, Susan. Are there questions for Ms. Russell? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Ms. Russell. The animal control officers are acting for the state on their behalf. It's not like just somebody walking down the street. They're trying to do their job, so you don't think they should qualify for a higher classification when they're assaulted when they're working?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I think because some of the circumstances that can be involved, I think with police officers, we have sort of a different standard of training. I think it's been mentioned. And I think that there may be circumstances that are particularly abhorrent and may be particularly sort of aggravated in terms of that. But our concern is there may be circumstances where it's less apparent. The involvement may be more tangential and maybe more unclear in the circumstances. So.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Russell? Okay, thank you very much, Susan. Is there anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 487? We'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 487. Representative Barker.
I'd like to make a motion that we move Senate Bill 487 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Hummel.
Excused.
McPherson.
Aye.
Sazan.
Aye.
Shetterly.
Excused.
Chair Williams.
Aye. Senate Bill 487 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barker, you'll carry the bill.
Thank you.
We're now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 315. I'll invite up Senator Burdick and Mr. Waring from ODOT, if you're here. Mr. Waring here from ODOT, if you want to come up with Senator Burdick, we'd appreciate that. When you're ready, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Williams, and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick, and I represent Senate District 18. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 315. Senate Bill 315 is a simple bill. It would require motorists to stop, as opposed to current law, which requires only that a motorist yield to pedestrians. This new wording of the statute will eliminate vague terms and give motorists a clear idea of what they should do when they see a pedestrian crossing or attempting to cross the street. As most of you who have been pedestrians are aware, yield can mean many things to many people. To some people it means that you stop and actually let the person have a little space to cross the street. For other people it means just swerve in and out and just barely miss them, which can be terrifying and dangerous. We had in Senate Judiciary, we had the Commander Garvey of the Portland Police Bureau testify in favor of this. He's head of the Traffic Division. We also had Lieutenant Hess from the Hillsborough Police Department, who works in their Traffic Division, testify in favor of it, and also a representative at the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. And one of the more interesting things in Commander Garvey's testimony was that some pedestrians will be crossing the street and then they'll remember something or whatever, and for whatever reason they'll turn around and go back across. I'm sure we've all done that. I've certainly seen it and done it myself. What Senate Bill 315 would do is it would require drivers to stop and remain stopped until a car was at least one lane away. And the reason we wrote it that way is in a two-lane street, the car would have to stop until the person continued crossing the street. And, of course, this applies to legal crosswalks only. And but for a four-lane road, that the pedestrian would only have to be one lane away, and then the cars could proceed through. I actually saw this work in action the other day. I was coming up to the Capitol, and there is a crosswalk right in front of the Capitol. And I was crossing the street because I go walking 2 days a week with Senator Metzger, who's a co-sponsor of this. And a car actually did stop and stayed stopped till I was well across the street, and it made such a huge difference. And I wondered how that driver happened to know that this bill was about to become law. So I appreciate your attention to this bill. Commander Garvey and Lieutenant Hess are just two of the law enforcement officers around Oregon who believe that this will make a difference in pedestrian fatalities. And so I would appreciate your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Why don't we have Mr. Warren? Do you need to leave now?
No, I can wait for
questions. Okay, Mr. Warren, if you'd give us your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Williams, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. My name is Rick Waring, and I work for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I work with Troy Costales, or for Troy Costales, in the Safety Division. Our program uses federal safety funds to implement a number of programs around the state that are designed to improve pedestrian safety. In 2001, 60 Oregonians were killed as pedestrians, and 577 were injured. Over 50% of these were in a crosswalk when that occurred. In fact, motorists hit 292 pedestrians crossing in a crosswalk in 2001. Far too many drivers are in a hurry, and they don't want to stop. This is evidenced by the frequency of red light running, which we've all seen. This failure to stop when it results in a crash between two motor vehicles can certainly be costly, but when it happens to a pedestrian, it's going to result usually in serious injury. Looking at the data, 62% of car-to-car collisions don't result in any injury. They result in property damage only. But none of the 565 pedestrian crashes fail to produce some kind of injury. I can tell you that my background includes 5 years as a trauma nurse in a trauma center, and we always dreaded when the pedestrian calls came in because they were always ugly and very often they were deadly. This bill addresses a problem that's getting worse as traffic volumes grow. Oregonians don't feel safe crossing their streets. Even when drivers do slow down, too often they hurriedly drive past with just a minimum of often intimidating clearance that frightens the pedestrian. The fact is, we need to feel safe walking in our community. A staggering 60% of Oregonians are overweight or obese, conditions that are associated with a host of chronic debilitating diseases. So we need to encourage Oregonians to walk more. And Senate Bill 315 will help this in three ways. First, it will provide clear directions to motorists to slow down, stop, and remain stopped when required by the bill. Second, Senate Bill 315 will provide law enforcement with definite parameters to define a violation when it occurs. And third, as a result of the first two, Oregonians will feel safe and comfortable when they walk. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions if I can, please.
Thank you, Mr. Waring. Representative Brzozinski.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Senator Burdick or Mr. Waring to walk me through the Section 1-1, starting on line 15 through 21. I've looked at this in the office and started doing little grid charts to figure out where it would apply to or how it would apply. My reading of that 1A, it says if there's no traffic control device, a vehicle is going to have to stay stopped and remain stopped until the person completely clears the road, because it looks like it says
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burdick or Senator Burdick?
What this applies to is this refers to the fact that that it's not just marked crosswalk. There are legal definitions of crosswalks in the Oregon statutes. You know, any place where roads converge with intersections, and you can add to this if you want. That's a legal crosswalk, even though it's not marked. The section that you are referring to, the issue you're referring to, is whether they have to wait till they get across the road. If it's a two-lane road, they do have to wait until the pedestrian has gotten entirely across the road.
Okay.
If it's more than two lanes,
then
just one lane needs to separate them.
And then I think that's what I want to do. I just want to set the record, make sure we have it set. And I understand that. And then the second part says, if there's is either in the lane in which the driver's vehicle is traveling or the lane adjacent to the lane in which the driver's vehicle is traveling. So if we were out here where you have a three-lane road, if the driver is in the middle lane, they're going to have to wait until that person has cleared the complete crosswalk, because adjacent lanes are going to prohibit them from moving as if they were in the outside lane or the inside lane. Once they've cleared the adjacent lane, then they'd be able to move?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Any further? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Waring, is it?
Yes, sir.
I think you said there's something about 50 people were killed in crosswalks.
Yes,
is that correct?
No. Excuse me. Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, 50 people were killed, but not all of those were in crosswalks.
Okay. How many do you have were in crosswalks?
It was a Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, it was approximately half of those.
About half of
those. Yes, sir.
And of that half, how many were killed because the car failed to stop at all or because it stopped and then proceeded on after the person had cleared the path immediately in front of them?
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, I don't have that specific information.
Mr. Representative Fairley.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Jensen, I thought you were finished.
I wanted to go to then perhaps injury, and maybe don't have that information either, but my question would be about the number of injuries that occur because a car stops at a crosswalk to allow a pedestrian to cross and then proceeds before that pedestrian has either cleared the street or gotten through one lane, as whatever the case that applies might be. Do we have any information on that?
Chair Williams, may I ask to go get a piece of information I have in my briefcase?
Certainly.
I may have that information.
And while he's gone, I just was reading over his shoulder. It's actually 60 pedestrians were killed, and half of those were in crosswalks.
And Mr. Chairman, if I'll jump in and waste some time, too. I wanted to make it clear, too, that on Section 4...
That's our job.
Okay.
No.
I just want to make it clear that...
Verdict job.
I want to make it clear that Section 4 is the section that would apply if there is a pedestrian light, if there's a walk, don't walk bill, or excuse me, light. And it makes it clear that this only applies if the pedestrian is walking and is lawfully within the intersection. Would it be a traffic violation? How is that?
Good. Mr. Waring?
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, I can provide you with some more detailed analysis of the data, but I can tell you from our performance plan that we put out each year that in every collision there's some responsibility, usually on multiple parties. It's very seldom, as you know, going to be all one person's fault. And in 2000, drivers committed a contributing error in 53% of the collisions that involved a pedestrian. Of those errors, 76% were failure to yield to the pedestrian.
Mr. Chair, may I just
Representative Jensen.
Clarify, but failure to yield may include and likely does include those who didn't stop at all. And that'd be my assumption that most of those were those who didn't stop at all.
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, I'm not sure about the latter statement, but I think you're right about the first one.
Representative Shirley, did you have a question?
Well, I just want to make sure that I understand this now. There, either under current law or under this bill, this doesn't require a driver to stop where the pedestrian is on the curb, does it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shirley, the key is when the pedestrian is in the crosswalk.
And I guess I want to make sure that commences at the edge of the curb, right? Okay, because I would be concerned about a requirement that you stop if they're at the curb for risk that, you got a kid who sees someone in the lane across the road coming and stops and steps right out in front of somebody who's not preparing to stop. Okay. We need some driver education.
Yeah, I think that's the California standard, is that if you're at the crosswalk and not stepped off, but we've always required them to actually make that that step.
Actually, I think that's safer.
Yeah.
Both feet or one?
All four.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you. Senator Bray, maybe you'd answer. Downtown Portland, you have the wait and walk sign. So I'm going to make a left turn on a red light. A pedestrian crosses in front of me. I have to wait till they go completely clear of the street. I can't turn the corner in the two-lane roads.
That's correct. The one-lane buffer applies whether you're taking a legal right turn on a left, or even in some cases a legal left turn on a red. I meant to say red light. That requirement of stopping and remain stopped applies regardless of the scenario, as long as the pedestrian is in a legal crosswalk.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Waring.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 315, and I'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I didn't probe this bill as thoroughly as some of my colleagues did, but I am nonetheless quite enthusiastic about the principle it stands for, and based on my belief that we don't we have a mismatch in terms of the power between our pedestrians and our cars, and we need to do what we can to give our pedestrians legal rights, I will move Senate Bill 315 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson speechifies a motion to move Senate Bill 315 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? All right. Call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Wazowski.
Aye.
Chevrolet.
Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 315 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative McPherson has earned himself the carrierness of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're now going to go to work session, colleagues, on House Bill 3385. This shouldn't take long. Mr. Vile, if you want to come forward. We have had, this is the condominium and planned communities bill, colleagues, in front of us, and we've heard various iterations with concerns about various amendments. We have the dash fives in front of us. Mr. Vile, the dash fives are a compromise amendment, is that right?
That's correct. We've, Williams, members of the committee, we have talked with both Oregon Association of Realtors and the mortgage bankers, and as you know, I've talked with several of you as well, in an attempt to make sure we've ferreted out all concerns with this bill. We believe we have. The dash five amendments are reflective of those. There's one glitch in it that I believe is inconsequential, but we said that sections 2 and 22 were taken out, and you see 22 is still there. There was a 22A, and what happened is legislative council simply moved 22A into 22. The two that were supposed to be taken out really have been taken out.
Okay, fair enough. Any questions for Mr. Vile about the dash five amendments? I'm looking. Anybody else who has had concerns about these want to come up and say anything? All right, hearing done. Representative Przanski.
We're in work session.
We are.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill or Dash 5s and HB 3385.
Representative Przanski moves the Dash 5s to House Bill 3385. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The Dash 5s are in. Representative Przanski?
Move House Bill 3385 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 3385 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Call the roll, Nancy.
I come in.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Excuse
me.
Aye.
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 House Bill 3385 is amended. Moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteers for carrying this one?
I'll take it.
All right, Representative Ackerman, you've earned yourself that bill. All right. All right, we'll jump back up to the top of the agenda. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 303. And Ms. Kunkel and Sugar, if you're both here, if you'd come up. Welcome, and whoever would like to maybe begin.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jean Kunkel. I'm a deputy district attorney from Marion County. I'm in charge of the domestic violence team there. And
my name is Kamala Sugar. I'm a deputy DA in Lane County, and I'm also in charge of the domestic violence and misdemeanor team in Lane County.
You notice, Kamala, I didn't try to do your name again. So much easier just to call you Ms. until I hear you say it again for me. So thanks. Thanks very much. Okay, please begin.
Chairman Williams and members of the committee, we're here to support Senate Bill 303, which is a bill that's sponsored by the ODAA. It's basically a technical change to the criminal code. There are right now several crimes that require us to prove as an element of the crime that a domestic violence relationship existed. A couple examples of those are in the aggravated animal abuse bill, that crime is elevated to a felony if the defendant has previously been convicted of two or more crimes of domestic violence, domestic assault. Similarly, there are some evidence code provisions that allow us to impeach the defendant if he testifies at trial with prior convictions for domestic violence. Right now, there is nothing to officially designate those convictions. Oh, I'm
sorry. Representative Jensen, do you have a question?
The reference to he?
To E.
Domestic violence is always a male?
No, perfect. He's not.
Thank you.
And I do use that because it is the majority, but that's true. They can be either female or male defendants.
Thank you.
Right now, what is required, what we're trying to do is to officially designate those crimes that involve a domestic violence relationship as in the title, domestic violence, which would then allow us to basically move forward on these new crimes that require that as an element without having what we have to do now is sometimes a court hearing for the court to decide whether that prior conviction did in fact involve a domestic violence relationship. So really, we're proposing this because we think it would be more efficient, get the cases moving along, and save court time, attorney time, and indigent defense costs.
All right. Thank you.
If I can just add, thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. It's really, my understanding is that this has been evaluated as having a minimal fiscal impact. It's something that actually we're required by the courts to already put an asterisk on the pleading of the charging instrument to indicate that it's a crime of domestic violence. This would require us in the underlying charge to prove it. It would have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury or to a judge. As in every other element of the crime, and then later, subsequently, that conviction has this connotation attached to it. So it is kind of a technical fix.
All right. Are there further discussion questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Pozanski.
So basically what we're doing is we'll be able to identify it so it can be used for enhancement purposes in the future.
Enhancement purposes, purposes of impeachment, and other things like that.
Representative Pozanski?
We're not.
Anything else? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Council Prinz had gone to make photocopies for anybody who wanted a copy of ORS 135-230 that defines domestic violence. I'm not sure that we necessarily need them, but he thought that might be helpful. No one else has signed up on Senate Bill 303. Is there anyone else here to speak to the bill? Yeah, Ms. Christian, you may.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you. I had not signed up on this bill, but based upon the recent testimony, I just need to make the record on behalf. I'm Ann Christian, Director of Indigent Defense with the Oregon Judicial Department. Make the record that the Judicial Department certainly has no position on this bill. We did submit a fiscal impact statement, and I presented testimony on the Senate side that just made it clear that we are assuming that this bill does not require that the domestic violence, if domestic violence is proved, that the Oregon Judicial Information Network will not, absent reprogramming, which is very expensive to this very old system, that OJIN would not have that designation. Further, it would not be forwarded on to LEDS. On the Senate side, I let the District Attorneys Association know that fact, and the Judicial Department and the DAs have worked together to have these flags on domestic violence cases, but they don't automatically get transferred to LEDS for purposes of criminal histories. We certainly think that that would be good, and one of the suggestions that we have is that an interim group look at what it would actually take to have that capability during the interim.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Ann? All right, thank you, Ann. Anyone else here on 303? All right, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pozanski.
I move Senate Bill 303 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Pozanski moves Senate Bill 303 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Parker.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Tomahawk.
Excused.
Pearson.
Excused.
Pozanski.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 303 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Yeah, Representative Pozanski, that's fine. All right, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 306 and ask Mr. French and Ms. Sugar to come back up, if you would, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Yes.
My name is Alfred French. I'm a senior deputy district attorney for Clackamas County. I'm here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. This is a bill that we sponsored. Conceptually, this bill is very simple. It changes the culpable mental state for the crimes of failure to appear in the first and second degree from intentional to knowing. And there's essentially two reasons that we're asking that this change be made. One has to do with the responsibility of the defendant for getting to court, and the other one has to do with the proving of this crime when it's been violated. The way that the statute is presently written, the defendant does not violate this law unless he intentionally fails to appear. That means if he forgets to set his alarm clock, decides to go out on a bender the next morning and can't get up, just is totally negligent, loses his notice, forgets about it, then his failure to appear in court is not a crime. The proof issues kind of dovetail with the responsibility issues, and that is that a mental state proofs always require the district attorney to prove what's going on in somebody's mind. We have to prove that he intended not to show up in court the way that the statute is presently written. And that is very difficult to do a lot of times, and usually it's done by circumstantial evidence, but the defendant can very easily come in and make up a story that he lost his notice, or just if he comes in and says, hey, I forgot about it, that's a defense. If this statute were changed the way that we request, the defendant would still have the defenses available of impossibility or the defense of choice of evil. So we're not turning it into a strict liability offense. We're really just saying if the defendant knew about it, then it's his responsibility to get to court unless there's some reason that he couldn't get there.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Sugar.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, Kamala Sugar, Lane County District Attorney's Office. I don't know whether it would assist the committee for me to read the definitions of intentionally and knowingly so we can establish the differences, if that would be helpful, if anyone has questions.
Sure, please.
Intentionally and with intent requires that the person act with a conscious objective to cause the result or engage in the conduct described. With the definition of knowingly, it's still a pretty high level of requirement. That requires that the person act with an awareness that the conduct is of such a nature so described, or that the circumstance so described exists. So basically, they have to act knowingly or with knowledge. It still requires them to know that what they're doing is not showing up for court, for example. Other examples of someone not being able to go would still be a defense, but for the state to have to prove, for example, that the person had a conscious objective to not show up for court, as opposed to choosing to oversleep their alarm clock and then choosing to go for a long breakfast. I mean, there are some arguments that get made in court that are maybe Mr. French can even give some better examples than I can. The other thing that I wanted to indicate was that failing to appear for court is actually a huge problem. And one of the reasons that it's become such a large problem for the courts and for defense lawyers and for prosecutors is that every time someone doesn't show up for court, a warrant goes out for their arrest. And it costs the court and the sheriffs and everyone quite a bit of money to issue the warrant, have to bring them back into court. And then when they're arrested, a lot of the jails in this state don't have room to hold them, even for their next court appearance. And so one of the few things that's left for us to do is charge this person with this additional crime for failing to appear for court. And it has gotten to the point that prosecutors show up for that trial, defense attorneys who are being paid by the state show up for that trial, but the defendant doesn't show up. And you know, there are times when half of the docket for a trial day doesn't show up for trial. So I just wanted to place that on the record and explain to you why this is such a huge problem. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Sugar. Representative Barker.
And if I might add, I know up in Portland, oftentimes several officers show up at a six-hour minimum pay to be told you can go home after 5 minutes. So.
That's correct.
We like that.
Representative Jensen. Yeah, you helped negotiate that, didn't you, Representative Barker?
Indeed.
Representative Jensen.
Is there some guarantee in here that the change of this word is going to get all those people to show up?
Chair Williams and Representative Jensen, I wish I could say that there was, but there's no guarantee. It does enable us to prosecute more of those failures to appear.
Anything else? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Russell.
Susan Ruff on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we're here in opposition to Senate Bill 306, and I wanted to sort of give some examples of some kinds of circumstances and some of the types of situations where we feel that changing the mental state from intentional to knowing can cause problems. The descriptions you've heard already are correct. So when we talk about intention, we think of sort of a conscious objective versus knowledge being an awareness. The problem we see with this bill of changing the mental state is that there are a number of court appearances. We talk about a trial. That's sort of one would think that that's sort of an aggravated failure to appear, put it that way, that the defendant is probably, more aware than not of that appearance. But in a court, sort of in the length of a criminal prosecution, and particularly with the budget cuts and setovers that have taken place, In a case where a defendant is out of custody, particularly on a lower-level charge, there can be dozens of court appearances. Sometimes court appearances are set over with very short notice. And so
So I think it's sort of, when we think about sort of this failure to appear, this sort of blatant failure to appear to trial, I wanted to kind of remind the court that there are a number of other appearances that are sort of, I would say, a less significant sort of case status as appearances, where it can be that the defendant may have an awareness because of prior documentation or information, but not at a conscious objective, put it that way, that the defendant is sort of unaware at that point of the dates because of the number of dates. So that's one concern, is sort of the number of appearances that there are in these cases, and the fact that someone may be unaware but yet not be acting with a conscious objective on these sort of less significant. Our second concern, which is really a larger one, is that there may be circumstances that intervene with an individual being able to get to court. We've had people that have been charged for failure to appear when they've been incarcerated. We've had people have been charged with failure to appear when they've been incarcerated in the same courthouse in which they've failed to appear. Sometimes people can be incarcerated on different charges, unrelated charges, and that may not show up, or would unlikely to be showing, may be very unlikely to show up. There is a concern with respect to people being incarcerated on new criminal charges that the argument could be made that by engaging in criminal conduct and getting themselves arrested, they didn't act with a conscious objective by being incarcerated not to show up, but that they acted with an awareness. There may be intervening events that are beyond the defendant's control, an illness of a child or transportation difficulties, the defendant's illness, matters such as those that the defendant would be acting with an awareness that they were had a scheduled court appearance, perhaps, but yet it may not raise the level when we're talking about these sort of impossibilities or justifications under the sort of very exceptional defenses. So in those kind of circumstances, sometimes we'll have a defendant that have an unforeseen transportation difficulty. Let's say, for example, that there's a breakdown on the TriMet and they've planned with adequate time to get to the court, and the TriMet is blocked because of a car accident and they don't make it to court. They have an awareness that they were to be at court. They may have used adequate time to get on the train or get on the bus, and for intervening events that have nothing to do with them, are unable. And this is not what we're talking, you know, when we're talking about sort of these short appearances, their court appearance may be a matter of 15 or 20 minutes and they miss it. They may be an hour late. And so those people would be acting, if we change the law, with an awareness, but not with a conscious objective. And I think that that's a really different type of culpability and standard of someone that is aware, but because of intervening acts is incapable of getting there. And I can tell in terms of the defenses that the court's, you know, response in those kind of situations is plan accordingly, or that, you know, that they're not, put it this way, it's often an unsympathetic ear in terms of failure to appear when intervening acts occur. It's different in terms of a criminal prosecution with the requiring an intent versus an awareness. But I anticipate in those kind of situations that we would see prosecutions when we're talking about people who really have a different level of culpability. So for those reasons, we oppose the change. It's been my experience with the failures to appear that are prosecuted. I have not personally aware, and I didn't hear a number of specific circumstances. I would agree with the proponents that sometimes people make crazy arguments as to why they have failed to appear. But I'm personally not aware, and the offices that I've worked at, in terms of circumstances where they've prosecuted, and there's been a hard time for the state to prove under the intentional mental element. So I didn't hear cases that were given as examples. And as I say, I'd agree when they're talking about the sort of ludicrous of wanting to go out for a cup of coffee. That's a ludicrous defense, and it's not one, in my experience, that prevails as a defense in these kind of prosecutions.
Let me ask you, Susan, though, in the cases that you gave, for example, where you've had somebody prosecuted for failure to appear when they were already being held in a jail in the very same facility, I mean, those prosecutions didn't go all the way through the process with a conviction, did they? I mean, when somebody figured out that the guy was already in the lockup, the case got dismissed, I would suspect.
Mr. Chair, I would have to look back at those cases. I am aware of one case that was in Washington County where somebody had been in a different county, and the response of the court sort of on a preliminary motion to dismiss was that the defendant, by engaging in criminal conduct, had, knowing that the defendant had a pending criminal case, sort of assumed the risk of not appearing. And so I'm aware, because that has been talked about at the time, that it was sort of, you know, I don't know if the case got resolved by a plea or how it happened, but I know that sort of the initial response was, you know, no, that's not going to remove the case as a matter of, you know, of law up front.
This is sort of the dog ate my summons bill a little bit. I mean, I've sat down at call enough to watch the people who have stumbled in after mm-hmm. the warrant's been issued, and, you know, by and large, if they're there in a reasonable period of time, I've always seen the court be very accommodating mm-hmm. to address, you know. I mean, I've also seen mm-hmm. them admonish people mm-hmm. who, you know, didn't plan to figure out that when they were driving downtown to the Multnomah County Courthouse, they ought to allow themselves a couple of minutes to figure out where they were going to park their car mm-hmm. In order to get into that courthouse. But, I mean, it also seems to me that only in the extreme circumstances would a district attorney be all that interested in mucking around with this, except in a case where mm-hmm. somebody was really sort of flouting and really coming in with the sort of the dog ate my summons mm-hmm. kinds of excuses. Mm-hmm. I guess I just feel like at some point you have to make people responsible. They've been arrested, they've been charged, they've been hauled into a court, they've been told that they need to come back at a particular time mm-hmm. or there could be consequences, and I think if we don't say there could be consequences, that accountability message never gets through. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think either judges nor DAs are going to waste a lot of time on this, except in situations where they really got somebody who's either been sort of a habitually non-showing up, or somebody who frankly just doesn't have a good reason for why they didn't come, or they put the court mm-hmm. and a whole bunch of people, mm-hmm. at inconvenience as a result of that.
Uh-huh. Mr. Chair, I think that's definitely a fair representation of what's my experience in Multnomah County, is that my practice in Multnomah County was, as yours is that a call that the judges tend to admonish, but tend to, when someone really has made the effort to get there, is not to go to the waste of issuing a failure to appear warrant, that those cases aren't prosecuted. I knew it for a long period of time. I think it's still the case that the Multnomah County District Attorney's Association had the policy that they only prosecuted failures to appear when the individual failed to appear day of trial because of the greater expense and inconvenience. I've also practiced that in Washington County, and I can tell you in Washington County, they prosecute failures to appear as a matter of course. And I have been in many courtrooms where a defendant is 5 to 10 minutes late, where a failure to appear warrant has been issued. So I know that there's a significantly different practice in Washington County, and I would say it's a very aggressive practice by the courts and the DAs. So I think there is a big difference, that may be unfortunate, but I think that because of that, we have sort of heightened concerns that it's not going to always be sort of the good sense of the DA or the good sense of the judge that's going to prevail.
Okay, are there questions for Ms. Russell? Okay, thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Anybody else here on Senate Bill 306 want to testify? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 306. We'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Posonski.
Move Senate Bill 306 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Posonski moves Senate Bill 306 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
McPherson.
Excused.
And Crummel's excused.
Yes.
Devonsky.
Aye.
Shadowing.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 306 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
It is very gratifying for me to be on the Judiciary Committee and find that people in your profession have had similar problems to what people in my profession have had.
Oh.
It's amazing at how many times dogs eat term papers.
All right. Anybody want to volunteer on this one? Okay, I'll take it. All right, last bill, Senate Bill 641, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 641 and call up Ms. Christian.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Christian, and I'm appearing on Senate Bill
641 on behalf of the Judicial Department and also the Public Defense Services Commission. Senate Bill 641 is a bill that Senator Ferrioli had introduced, and this bill would make Oregon statute crystal clear, I believe, that courts may order recovery of indigent defense costs at the conclusion of a post-conviction relief case. There was not a United States Supreme Court, there was an Oregon Supreme Court decision issued that did cause some confusion for some courts, many courts in eastern Oregon that have a fair number of these post-conviction relief cases. And Senate Bill 641 would simply make it clear in statute that judges may, based on ability to pay, order primarily inmates who file post-conviction relief to repay the costs. And we being the Public Defense Services Commission and the Judicial Department, support Senator Ferrioli's bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
I want a clarification. And in your testimony, you said for the recouping of the cost of court-appointed attorneys, but it looks like the bill does include for all costs.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brzezinski, it includes all indigent defense costs, so if there were investigative costs, those are always included within recoupment as well.
But not actual cost of that running a court or the courtroom or anything like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, not costs associated with a trial or anything other than indigent defense related.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for Ms. Christian? And did you work out a fiscal? Is there? We assume that I noticed in the report coming over from the Senate that Oregon case law already allows the court to order petitioner to repay the cost. This bill clarifies the policy. Because it's a clarification, are we anticipating that once it's more clear, we're going to recoup any money out of this, or do you think that's already happening?
Mr. Chair, it's been a long day, and I can't believe that I passed up the opportunity to comment on a fiscal impact statement that we prepared that actually estimates an increase in revenue, and the projected increase for the 2003-2005 biennium is estimated to be $75,000 to $112,500. This is based on the fact that because of the confusion during this past interim for a period of time, at least one court did not stop ordering recoupment. And so there was a loss of revenue that we now project would be recovered during the next biennium.
Now, this doesn't have a Ways and Means referral, but I assume you're going to, if we pass it, work those into the figures that you're working with the folks down at LFO to make sure that gets captured in the indigent defense budget?
Mr. Chair, we certainly will.
Okay. I just any stuff rolling around on the table, I don't want it to fall off and not get caught. So
it's more than a dime.
Yeah, it's more than a dime. Thanks.
Thank you.
Anything else, colleagues? Yes, you may. Yeah, sure. You have to tell me who you are when you come up.
I'm Laura Aviani, and I just wanted to bring to the attention of the committee, indigent defense really needs to be clarified in the state right now, and I'm asking for clarification of this. Recently, my husband was given a ticket for an animal getting out, which wasn't a neighbor had come up, left the gate open, and the horses went out because the teenage boys from the neighbors decided they weren't going to close it. When my husband went to court, he was told by the judge of Drain, Oregon, that there was no indigent defense and that he must pay for his own lawyer or take a charge of guilty. So I'm asking that you clarify indigent defense for the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
If I may respond, the rule is that if there's a possibility of your husband or anyone in the same situation based on the crime potentially going to jail or prison and have some type of incarceration, then there would be a duty to have
a court-appointed attorney available if they qualify for it. It sounds like your husband was not charged with a crime that would be, as compared to a violation. A violation is just a monetary fine as compared to actually potentially going to be
potentially corrected. It goes into a federal offense.
A federal offense?
Yes. Because of the intent again. The charge that has been brought up before is allowing livestock to run at large, which, as we all, cattle ranchers know, that if you have a lot of livestock and they go onto another person's land to eat, this is why the charge was created. Because you're allowing your livestock to run at large so that you don't have to feed them. But the charge has been changed to livestock at large, the allowing left out. If you have two or three of these charges, it can be deemed federal. It can be deemed a federal offense.
Ms. Aviani, here's what I think I'm going to ask you to do. You can talk to Ms. Christian from the Indigent Defense Services Division, who just testified previously on the bill, and I'm sure she'd be pleased to talk to you about the particular instance that you're referring to. I'll just put on the record that given our current budget crisis, I think few committees more than this one in this building recognize the challenge that we currently have in the indigent defense system, and seeing that it's properly funded, and we're continuing to work towards that.
But is it not the oath of our Senate and our House committees to protect the Constitution?
Well, we all swear that oath when we get elected. And
is not your defense in America your constitutional right?
They are, and Ms. Christian will be happy to talk to you about your particular case. So thank you for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 641 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Przanski.
I move Senate Bill 641 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves Senate Bill 641 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Okay, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Excused.
Parker.
Excused.
Hanson.
Aye.
Trummel.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 641 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Jensen will carry it. Okay. Committee, we're adjourned.